I'm Craig Calhoun. I used to do a lot more welcoming at LSE than I do now, but it's a pleasure to be able to welcome Tariq Modood to LSE for this talk tonight. Tariq is a very distinguished sociologist and researcher, probably best known for work on ethnic minorities in Britain, including leading a major survey that results in a book of that title, founding the journal Ethnicities, founding a research center at the University of Bristol on this, and doing a variety of different, more specific research projects on aspects of issues from employment to educational participation and the life of minorities in Britain generally. He has also done work in this connection on the way in which religion figures in British public life and in the life of different groups and in the even the shifting identification of different groups using sometimes national, sometimes ethnic, sometimes religious names for different minority groups. And he is a member of the commission that was created on religion and belief in British public life, and part of what he'll talk with us about is indeed the work of the commission, and I think some of his reflections on the intellectual and public issues raised by the work of the commission. So it's a pleasure to have Tariq Modood with us. We'll have first his presentation, then a little bit of discussion between us and hopefully you, and I think we can be informal with a small group and therefore have more and better discussion. So welcome, everyone. Welcome, Tariq.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Craig. Well, I'm delighted and honored to be part of your series, Craig, so thank you for that invitation. So I'm really going to focus very much on the commission that Craig just mentioned, the Commission on Religion and Belief in British Public Life, or CORA, which was convened by the Wolf Institute, Cambridge, chaired by Baroness Butler Sloss, a former senior judge, and reported in December 2015. It was the fulfillment of one of the recommendations of the Commission on Multi-Ethnic Britain, what I call CMEB, but a lot of people call the Parekh Report. I call it CMEB because Bhikkhu Parekh expressly said he didn't want it to be called the Parekh Report. I should declare an interest. I was not only a member of the CORA, but I was also a member of the CMEB. And the recommendation that CORA is a fulfillment of is at the bottom of that slide. One of our recommendations was that there should be a commission on the role of religion in the public life of a multi-faith society, to make recommendations on legal and constitutional matters. And CORUB then has this these terms of reference to consider the place and role of religion and belief in contemporary Britain and the significance of emerging trends and identities. B, examine how ideas of Britishness and national identity may be inclusive of a range of religions and beliefs and may in turn influence people's self-understanding. C, explore how shared understandings of the common good may contribute to greater levels of mutual trust and collective action and to a more harmonious society. And D, make recommendations for public life and policy. While the terms of reference do not refer to race, ethnicity, or even minorities, it should be clear that religion has primarily re-entered public life, political debates, mobilization, and policy making because of, in Britain as in the rest of Western Europe and beyond, the presence, assertiveness, and terrorism of Muslims, even though the terrorism in question is supported, let alone engaged in, by a very small proportion of Muslims. A good way to approach the Korab is through the argument that Britain consists of a Christian legacy, new faiths, and the non-religious. More specifically, that current debates about multiculturalism in relation to religion can, I think, be seen in terms of three contending forces, which may be expressed in the contentions, in these three contentions, that Britain's public institutions and national identity should reflect that it is, one, still predominantly a Christian country, and or two, now a multi-faith country, and or three, mainly a secular country. In relation to the last, we need to distinguish between several meanings of secular. Firstly, secular may refer to philosophical and ethical perspectives. Non-religion not as an absence, but as a presence, which I think it's a phrase I get from Craig. Not as the opposite of religion, but in terms of its status as a conversational partner of religion, or even as one of the many spiritual families, a phrase I get from Charles Taylor, one of the many spiritual families that constitute belief in modernity. One of the most fundamental conceptual features of the CORAB report is the importance it gives to such secular worldviews. What it refers, using the vocabulary of French legislation in relation to freedom of belief, to les convictions. While the CORAB report notes that such ideas developed during the Enlightenment and are at the core of ideas of equality and liberal democracy, and at times have been in an antagonistic relationship to religion, actually, I quote, the two sets of values have also at times intermingled and converged and have deeply influenced each other. Yet the decision to place religion and secular convictions on the same plane was arrived at not by a philosophical or theological discussion, but by a resolution at the first meetings to fully embrace the legal non-discrimination concept, religion or belief. And to express this in the title and in the terms of reference of the Commission. The UK Equality Act 2010, itself following the European Convention on Human Rights in relation to freedom of religion, expresses the legal offence of religious discrimination by reference to religion or belief. That is to say, religion and secular beliefs are treated on a par. CORAB took the legal category, religion or belief, up to now only applied to in relation to non-discrimination and freedom of religion, and applied it to all aspects of the report. For example, to education and the media and not just the law. Humanistic beliefs, principles and conscience are treated on a par with religion. One might say, though CORAB does not use this vocabulary, and that, you know, humanistic beliefs, principles and conscience are treated as an almost quasi-religion or alternative to religion, though that's not the vocabulary from CORAB. It did not mean that everyone who in a census or attitude survey said they had no religion had a humanist philosophy or participated in humanist meetings or rituals. But that was no disability, as this simply paralleled the situation of those who identified as Christian or Muslim. It is possible, however, that CORAB did not fully appreciate the implications of generalizing the equality between religious and non-religious belief. An example of this egalitarian inclusion, what I've elsewhere called equalizing upwards, is the recommendation that, I quote, funding for chaplaincies in hospitals, prisons and higher education should be protected, but with equitable representation for those from non-Christian religious traditions and for those from humanist traditions. So I think that's very much I'm using that as an illustration of how so much of Korab is about kind of protecting a certain kind of public provision in relation to religion at the moment, wanting to see it extended to non-Christian religions and to humanist traditions. A second meaning of secular can be understood in relation to political secularism. As a concept, it might be said to have two alternative contemporary understandings of secular. So meaning one is religion is a private matter and the state may act to confine it thus. Some British people often think that political secularism has exactly this meaning, till they reflect on Anglican participation in the national rituals, such as the remembrance of the dead in wars, or a royal wedding, or state-funded faith schools, which most British people have long supported and in the main continue to support. This then tends to lead British people to express the alternative view, namely, that religion has something to contribute to the public good, but should do so within liberal democratic constitutionalist norms and framework. What most British people approve of in political secularism is not an absolute separation between religion and the state, but that religion, as a feature of the public life of the country, works within, indeed freely and actively supports, the liberal democratic constitutional character of the British state and politics. It is perhaps not surprising that the first of these meanings is not represented in a commission investigating the place of religion in public life. But interestingly, that judging by the composition of Korab, secularist philosophies are not significantly represented. Indeed, there's only one commissioner whose affiliation is indicated by reference to a secularist philosophy, namely Andrew Copson, the chief executive of the British Humanist Association. Given, though, the fact of multiple identities, it would be appropriate to recognise that at least some members with a religious community, if not a religious organisation identification, are likely to overlap with secularist as well as religious perspectives. In fact, our bishop on the commission, Lord Richard Harris, former Bishop of Oxford, was happy to put himself in exactly that category as a Christian and as a humanist. So even though the Korab could be said to limit the scope of the secular vis-a-vis public religion relative to the concept of privatization and radical secularism, as per A, of more significance is how, by embracing an extensive concept of religion and belief, the Commission adjusted the balance within, adjusted or perhaps more accurately, readjusted the balance within the triangular relationship in favour of secularism. Not because of any animus to Christianity, but to an inclusive spirit in the context of socio-demographic trends to which I now turn. And these trends, I'm sure everyone's got some pretty good idea about them. I mean, this is, if you like, you know, the headline of the demographic trend, that there's a continuing decline of Christianity, there's a large increase in non-religious beliefs and identities, there's now an unmistakable presence of new religions. But let me just give you some detail or remind you of the necessary details. According to the census, the number of people who identified themselves as Christian in England and Wales declined from 71% to 58% between 2001 and 2011. So that's the first set of figures, as you can see, And ENW, of course, means England and Wales. While the censuses are of the full population, they're a relatively superficial measure of identification. In this regard, it is best to supplement the census with the British Social Attitudes, the BSA, survey findings, which is what CORAB does. The BSA, which includes Scotland, only has a sample of 3,000, but it is a systematic, purposive attitude survey and has been measuring religious attitudes annually since 1984. It shows that Christian identification has gone down from 68% in 1984 to 43% in 2014. This shows a steeper drop than the census, and so we might suppose that Christian identification has different meanings in different contexts, and or that the true picture is somewhere between the two figures. The BSA offers data by Christian denominations and shows that during 1984 to 2014, the numbers identifying as Anglicans declined from 40% to 17%, and Catholics from 10% to 8%. Other Christians remain steady at about 18% of the British population. While there has been a decline in older Protestant churches, such as the Methodists, Baptists, there has been a growth in newer churches, such as the Pentecostals and the Seventh-day Adventists, many of which are black majority-led. The findings are, then, that Christians are barely, or not at all, a majority in England and Wales, and Anglicans are no longer a majority amongst Christians. Though, of course, Anglican is an elastic identity, as indeed is Christian itself, as comparing the census and the BSA shows. Yet, Anglicanism does seem to have suffered a particularly steep decline. On the other hand, those who say they have no religion have gone up from 15% to 25% between the 2001 and 2011 census, and in the BSA, from just under a third in 1984 to almost half in 2014. The two data sets being more discrepant on this point than on Christians. The key point is that both data sets show the same trend and strongly suggest that it's not short term. As for religions other than Christianity, the BSA sample sizes are too small to be useful, but the 2001 and 2011 censuses show that significant number of non-Christian religious minorities are to be found in all the major cities and towns and doubled in size over that decade, comprising nearly 10% of England and Wales in 2011. Being younger and having larger families, they will continue to grow. For example, while Muslims are about 5% of the population, they are 8% of those under 25. While Hindus, Sikhs, Jews, and Muslims are about 12% of the 9 to 13-year-olds, three-quarters being Muslims, they are double this proportion in London. While for some right-wing newspaper commentators and editorials, the big story of the commission allegedly was one of Christian marginalisation and secular majoritarianism, I mean, disapprovingly, that was their take on it, my interest here is in the third point of the triangular relationship that I mentioned at the start, namely the minority faiths. While each new generation across the last century seems to be less Christian than its predecessor, and so few young people today deem Christianity to be important to their life, this generational indifference is much less amongst post-immigrant groups. Indeed, amongst ethnic minorities, expressions of commitment amongst the young can be exceptionally high. More than a third of Indians and two-thirds of Pakistani and Bangladeshi 16 to 34-year-olds said in a national survey at the end of the 20th century that religion was very important to how they led their lives, compared to a fifth of Caribbeans and 5% of whites. In the case of young Muslims, the importance of religion has been rising and overtaking their elders. Beyond that, religion has a social importance for minorities. In South Asia, from where the majority of British Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims originate, religious identity has a salience much higher than in Britain. So it is not surprising that during the last few decades, religion, rather than, say, colour or linguistic heritage or national origins, has risen in the individual and community self-identities of these minorities together with their sense of Britishness. Of course, groups are partly defined by not what they say they are, but what others, usually a dominant group, says they are. British society, as it happens, has been very receptive to ethnic minority self-definitions and redefinitions. For example, when West Indians said they were African Caribbean, when non-whites said they were not coloured, but blacks, when Asians said they were not black, ethnic minority collective self-projections quickly altered public discourses and prevailed over older nomenclature. So similarly, when ethnic minority groups such as Pakistanis started dismissing Pakistani and Asian for themselves in preference for Muslim, the wider British public, especially the media and public organisations, fell in line. This does not necessarily refer to religiosity, but is a recent manifestation of the well-known phenomenon that Jews generally and Catholics in locations like Northern Ireland can call themselves and be called by others as Jews and Catholics, respectively, even if they're not religious, and may even be anti-religious. We're here clearly talking about group identity or ethno-religious community membership, not belief. Of course, as indicated above, what minorities are usually unable to do is to control the meaning of terms. This again is most evident in the recent period, especially after 9/11, and in Britain, especially after the July 2005 bombings in London, 7/7, in relation to Muslims and Muslim identity or public discourses of Islam or about Islam. Muslims may have demanded recognition qua Muslims and may have propelled that identity into public discourse and popular consciousness, but very few Muslims have sought to have Muslim mean fanatic, fundamentalist, misogynist, separatist, or terrorist. But anyone familiar with current affairs and how it is reported in the British media knows that this is what to many Muslim currently connotes in Britain. This stereotyping of Muslims, part of the phenomenon generally called Islamophobia, can be understood as racialization. Not simply because this is what happens to groups designated as races, nor even because non-whiteness is closely associated with being a Muslim, but because it is to treat Muslims as if they were a single racial or quasi-racial group. The dissonance that one might experience here in accepting the idea that a religious group is a race can be eased by considering the general case of how the Jews have been racialized. Indeed, in continental Europe, the Jews are the quintessential race, as well as the specific case of Catholics in Northern Ireland or Muslims in the ethnic cleansing rampages in the former Yugoslavia. In this regard, it is worth noting that the CMEB recommendation, that's the PAREC report recommendation, that discrimination on grounds of religion or belief should be outlawed, which I quoted above. Well, actually, I didn't. Just got here by mistake. That it should be outlawed, began to be fulfilled from 2003 onwards, initially only in relation to employment, following an EU directive, later also covering services, and was fully implemented in the Equality Act 2010. In that act, religion or belief as a ground for discrimination was put on a par with all other grounds for discrimination in the strongest anti-discrimination legislation in Europe. The CORAB was very mindful of the phenomenon of religious discrimination and how it was often based on a racialized view of religion and intertwined with racial discrimination, suggesting that the term ethno-religious, which actually is a legal concept in Australia, captures an aspect of this. It did make a recommendation, CORAB did make a recommendation for the law to better understand this intertwining, but in the light of the 2010 Act, there was much less scope for it to make recommendations in relation to discrimination than might be the case in many other countries. It should be clear from the above that the meaning of religion can vary between religions, in particular between Christians and non-Christians, or between being a member of a majority or a minority religion. For Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs, religion is not just about belief, but also sometimes primarily about community and cultural heritage or identity, including resisting stereotypes about one's own community or discriminatory treatment. Yet another way in which religion is not just about belief is that it often requires a public performance or behaviour. For example, in relation to codes of dress or food, and so is much more publicly visible and sometimes requires institutional adaptation in order to be accommodated. While this is barely a feature of modern, especially Protestant Christianity, where inner belief can be considered sufficient and is often deemed unnecessary, perhaps even inappropriate, to display markers, even a cross of one's faith, this is quite exceptional in global and now British terms. Most religions require the observance of rules of piety, and Britain is experiencing such practice-based religions re-entering the public space, Muslim dress being the most visible and contentious, after quite a long period in which such religion has been eroded away or transformed into private belief. Institutions and areas of public life which have given up the need to accommodate Christians are now having to adjust to the needs of minority faiths, and sometimes stimulating Christian reappraisal of its retreat from public piety. For example, the display of a wearer's cross, as in the Iwaida case, the British Airways case that went up the European Court of Human Rights. A Christian woman said, "Why can't I wear a cross?" British Airways saying, "No, it doesn't fit the uniform." And she then pointed to various other religious minorities who were allowed to wear various things. Anyway, she won her case at the European Court. Dietary requirements, space for worship, and gender relations, besides dress, are also prominent as elements of what I'm calling religious praxis, that institutions such as schools, hospitals and prisons, and even workplaces are being asked to adjust to. Adaptations of codes of dress or uniforms, or provision of vegan, vegetarian, kosher and halal meals, places for worship, and time off to use them, are the kinds of requests being made upon state institutions, universities, employers. And so even when no parallel provision exists for Christians and is not being requested for Christians. So that was a long sentence. So just in case you missed the point, my point was that minorities are asking for accommodation even where Christians aren't accommodated. So it's not just a matter of consistency or parity where people said, well, Christians are allowed to do X, why aren't we? People are saying, Christians don't want to do X, fair enough, we do. So reply to our request. Don't tell us, oh, we don't accommodate this because no Christians want it. Which I think is, you know, quite a strong, relatively new logic of claims making by religious minorities in Britain and elsewhere. This praxis-based accommodation is a significant multiculturalist challenge because it's not simply a matter of granting minorities provision already enjoyed by the majority, but a matter of respecting minority religions in ways that Christians may be indifferent to in relation to their own faith. And of course, it's not just a symbolic recognition that is being requested, as substantive provisions or institutional changes are sometimes necessary. The net result of what I've been describing here is that minority religions have come to have a significant, even if contested, public presence. Public campaigns for inclusion and equality, conflicts over faith schools, women's dress and gender more generally, not to mention all the issues to do with the war on terrorism and Islamist radicalism, has made religion much more politically prominent and in public affairs generally. Public dialogue, representation and leadership is often sought and realized by those who define themselves in terms of religious community organizations. Whilst these are some of the reasons in which religion has become more publicly salient and in which the meaning of religion has changed, and so some appropriate public learning is required, it has also to be acknowledged that most people are losing touch with their own religious heritage, let alone understanding the new significance and variety of religion. At this juncture of simultaneous growth in ignorance about religions and their rising public, political, international, and geostrategic importance, CORAB makes one of its central recommendations, namely that there's a substantial need for raising the level of religion and belief literacy amongst the public, journalists, policymakers, and various kinds of professionals. The suggestion that the low level of public understanding of religion is a problem and needs to be remedied is not new to CORAB. What I believe is distinctive about CORAB is the understanding of religion that it is said greater literacy is needed of. Namely, religion which is extended to include secular belief systems, yet which is not reducible to belief, for it includes pious practice, as for example in relation to dress, which is a community or ethnic identity, especially for minorities, and which is intertwined with racism, such as in the case of anti-Semitism or Islamophobic racializing of Muslims as an other. This complex, multidimensional understanding of religion, the lack of literacy in which is a serious problem of public life, is a thread across the report and is fundamental in the report's discussions of law, the media, education, social action, and dialogue. Just as CORAB's generalization of the legal concept of religion or belief has extended religion in one direction, so the ideas of praxis, racialization, and identity in the concept of ethno-religious has extended it in another. Moreover, religious literacy is required across society, and especially by opinion formers and policy shapers and implementers, because religion in this extended sense has something to contribute to the common good. But this is not a crudely pro-religion view, nor just because secular beliefs and ethno-religious communities are folded into it. Corrib recognizes that religion as a public good, but also as a public bad. And so for, you know, it can be potentially good, it can be potentially bad. And so for both these reasons, governments have a legitimate and indeed a necessary interest in it. In Corrib, then, there is a thinking about the nature of multiculturalism in a changing context. In particular, with how religion, and not just colour, becomes the marker of minority status and of otherness. Most importantly, it is about the interaction of race, ethnicity, and religion, as in the concept of the ethno-religious, which, when combined with an extensive concept of religion and belief, displays in the British context a reworked concept of religion. At the same time, there is an affirmation in an evolving plural British national identity, one which cannot be taken for granted, but must be revisited as a work in progress. If the CMEB Parekh report is perhaps one of the most forceful statements of that view, it is instructive to also note a more balanced position in Corrib, and it's with this that I'll conclude. It has been remarked that the Parekh report had some ambivalence about Britishness. While it was wrongly perceived as suggesting that to be British or wanting to be British was racist, which is what some newspapers said, and it firmly put rethinking the national story on the race equality agenda, it was ambivalent about whether Britain was a nation and could achieve the goal of an anti-racist multicultural belonging or whether it was a post-nation. Corrib's terms of reference cited earlier indicate a much more affirmative view of Britain by making, I quote again, ideas of Britishness and national identity central to its purpose. A dialogical or multilogical Britishness seems to suggest itself as a goal, the solution to the problems discussed by Corrib. It is interesting that at a time when academic attention has been on globalization, the post-national, and transnationalism, British diversity has been centered on the national. In many ways, this is a more general European trend in which, when politicians talk of integration, they're not usually talking about European integration. I didn't just mean in Britain, I mean in Europe. They're not usually now talking about European integration, but about how to make the new minorities truly French, more German, and so on. Insofar as Britain differs, it is that the national identity is seen as something which itself should be understood in terms of diversity. This is present in the central message of both the commissions, though perhaps it is carried further in Corrib. While the CMEB Parekh report top bullet-pointed summary item emphasized, I quote, rethinking the national story and the national identity, Corrib explicitly foregrounded in its terms of reference the dialogical relationship between commonality and difference. I quote, examine how ideas of Britishness and national identity may be inclusive of a range of religions and beliefs and may in turn influence people's self-understanding. So it's much more two-way. The difference is perhaps slight, but while the CMEB emphasized, too one-sidedly in the view of its critics, the interrogation of dominant ideas of British national identity, Corrib emphasized the dialogical remaking of inherited national identities, which are both productive of minority inclusion and reflective of difference. Perhaps Corrib was merely trying to state the message of the Parekh report more clearly and avoid the brickbats received by the latter. If the Parekh report was interpreted as overemphasizing the deconstructive attitude towards received notions of national identity, Korab was careful to project a more constructive tone. I think that is a distinctive aspect of Korab, together with the endeavour to indicate a balanced, intertwined and evolving relationship between the Christian, the secular and the minority faiths through an affirmation, if implicit, through an affirmation of the existing moderate secularism with an established church, but more specifically, the two features I've been looking at: an extended concept of religion and belief, and the concept of the ethno-religious. Thank you.
That was great and really stimulating. And so I propose to go ahead and follow the script of asking you a few questions myself before opening it up. I had thought I would be more generous with time. So, where to begin on this? Let me start back at the beginning as you were recounting some of the mission that Korab took on and the account of religion and belief, secular and humanistic beliefs, and so forth. And I have a couple of questions I want to ask about that that are completely open-ended. I just wonder how people thought about this. You made it sound as though there was a forced choice between religion and secular belief, and then some people like the Bishop of Oxford who said, well, I don't accept that forced choice, although in the language of humanist rather than secular. And I want to ask more about the forced choice or the alternatives. The first question would be, what about the, in case of Bishop Oxford, the secular beliefs of religious people? Charles Taylor would make a case that secularism gets its start inside religion, thinking about things. Is it now the case that in a strong sense we're going to say there are secularists, there are religious people, and that's that? What kind of progress did you feel you made as a group to coming up with a way to think about a complex relationship between the two rather than a simple choice?
Yeah. I didn't mean to really suggest that there was a binary with a forced choice. You know, some people are religious, some people are secular. And it just so happens, nice Bishop of Oxford says he's both. I didn't mean to suggest that. I was actually reflecting on the fact that I think, you know, for better or for worse, we have ended up in the report having this rather extended and in institutional terms a very generous concept of religion and belief, because up to now it's just been simply acknowledged as an anti-discrimination concept. Mm-hmm. Whereas we say wherever there's religion, make provision for non-religious people with belief systems. Now, I personally, there's no one here from the commission, but I wonder if we really did think that through, actually. We made that decision so early on in the first two meetings, and we did it completely unanimously and with relatively little discussion, certainly no theological or philosophical discussion. We basically said, look, here's a legal concept. It embodies contemporary equality. We embrace it and we'll build on it. But at the time we started, you know, when we said we embraced it, we didn't know what the building on it would mean, because that just the architecture evolved very, very slowly afterwards. And I think that our kind of embrace of that concept in some ways was a kind of blank check, and we didn't know exactly what figure we were writing on that check. And to some extent, I don't think we still do. But no one has resiled against it. So I don't mean to suggest that there's loads of kind of remorse or anything like that. Not at all. I haven't heard anyone say anything about it, actually. I myself am reflecting. I wonder what exactly we have committed ourselves to. So this is a a genuine reflection. And then I added that despite the fact that we have this rather large-scale commitment to putting secular beliefs on a par with religion, it's not because we were stacked full of secularists. Mm-hmm. We actually weren't. There was only one person who said they were a secularist or a humanist, the chief executive of the British Humanist Association. What I then said was, of course, there is a way in which I think quite a few members of the commission were actually humanists in the non-exclusivist sense, of which the Bishop of Oxford was the most explicit example, from someone who clearly has a religious organisation role. But I think other people in the commission who didn't have a religious organisation role but had more of a community affiliation, they were very likely to be humanists and secularists and so on. So I think we had genuinely multiple identities. Mm. Yeah.
So one, just to push this a little bit further, I won't go on about it forever. There are, I would suspect, people or belief systems for whom the analogy sort of holds, the symmetry, okay, religious beliefs, secular beliefs, and then questions where it doesn't. And so part of what I wonder about is what happens to people who are, whose beliefs do not involve religion and are in the immanent frame, to borrow Charles Taylor's concept. There's sort of, you know, things in this world explain things in this world, and we don't have need of hypotheses reaching beyond that. But who would not say they identify with any particular secularist, humanist, atheist tradition? Does the way in which this gets treated imply some sort of symmetrical need to belong to a particular tradition? You used a phrase about humanist traditions. Okay, I think there are a variety of humanist traditions. I suspect that most people who consider themselves humanists don't consider belonging to any of them. Mm. So is there now a premium being produced on belonging to an identifiable something by this notion of a parity between religion and secularism?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the short answer is no. And here I'm...
Or at least not intentionally.
Sorry?
Or at least not intentionally. That's not...
Yeah, it's not what we were intending to do, and I don't actually think we've ended up doing it necessarily. I'll borrow Grace Davies' very nice expression of believing without belonging, which means people say they believe in something, but they don't belong to a church or a religious organization. Like, so I think the point that you were making about quite a lot of people who would just generally regard themselves as run-of-the-mill, religiously indifferent, secular people, actually, there's a large body of religious people who are like that, mm-hmm. who say they believe something, they don't know what they believe, and they say, they may put it, to paraphrase you, they may say, I know there's a Christian tradition, and I'm at the kind of, you know, outer end of it, but I, you know, I'll make up my own mind about these things. Some of them mean something to me, and some of them don't, but it doesn't mean that I want to wear a badge saying X. And of course, this is part of the problem of what people tick when they tick census boxes and things like this, and why we get quite discrepant figures. I think that we have these two concepts that I was saying were quite central to the Commission's thinking, and that we've tried to do something distinctive with them, partly by, if you like, inflating them, but not unreasonably inflating them. I mean, I'm defending our use of them. We've got the concept of religion or belief, which moves in one direction because it says, oh, religious people believe stuff, but non-religious people believe stuff. Non-religious people's beliefs should be given the same kind of respect as religious people. But these are something fairly amorphous, and they float in the air, and you can believe something one day and another day you might believe something else. And then we have the other concept of the ethno-religious, which says
well, not sure what we believe, but we know where we that we're members of something, and our social location circumscribes our, you know, consciousness or our possibilities of who we are and so on. And sometimes our social location is done in an exclusivist way, and we actually want to be included and so on.
Yeah.
So I think we want both. We want believing without belonging, and we also want quite a lot of belonging without believing.
Right. So I'm probably belaboring this too long. I'll come back one more time. So I get and like that part of the symmetry. So there are ethnic Jews and lapsed Catholics and all manner of people who have some relationship to a religious label, and if not possibly tradition, but it isn't defined by current belief or practice per se. And there's that, and there are like that. But I'm thinking about things like the difference between among philosophers, when I think of this, between those who have secularist beliefs, or Richard Dawkins or something, will say, I'm a secularist. I'm, in fact, in his case, an atheist, and declare that is a philosophical belief. And those who subscribe to a philosophy, they believe in things, they are professional philosophers, they believe in deontic logic or something, you know, they believe in something that does not thematize whether it is religious or not religious or whatever else it is. They believe in a particular kind of ethics, and they argue it without the distinction religious, not religious figuring in it in various ways. And so I sort of wonder if there's I'm not proposing that Korab ought to have included it, but I'm wondering about a third differentiation around thematizing, not thematizing. And it would seem to me that many, many people who are secular are not secularists in that sense. They may say, you know, I'm a chemist, I believe in science, but I don't have a position on whether science is or isn't religion, or isn't like a religion, or something, that there's a non-thematized sort of position. I'm a utilitarian. Does it follow that all utilitarians must be either atheist or, you know, secularist or whatever? And then at the end of it, morphing it slightly different question, we could go to religion and ask a somewhat similar question. Religions vary, but even more people's relationships to religion vary in the extent to which they are belief-centered. I would suggest that, in a way, we're having a very Protestant discussion about all of this, in which believing, in a certain sense, has taken on this very central role in a kind of discussion that we wouldn't have in many other settings where declarations of belief didn't take on the significance they took on in early modern Europe in the era of the Protestant Reformation. And so that even for the secular and for other religious traditions which in other settings might not be governed by declarations of belief in the same sense, we've absorbed them into this belief-centered Protestant work. And it was done by the Equalities Act before you ever did it, but it nonetheless brings all of this into a zone where beliefs and adherence to beliefs is the currency. And that just seems to me interesting to observe, and perhaps in varying degrees at odds with the way some people live either religion or secularism.
Yeah, I mean, two very quick points. One is, if there are people who, say, look, I don't want to be pigeonholed. You know, life is not as simple as that. My spirituality, my sense of who I am, is a much bigger question than wearing a badge. I mean, the question then arises, well, are there any public policy implications of that question? Because it's quite plausible to say there are none. Because if they say, look, I don't need anything special in a hospital, I don't need a particular kind of school to reflect my ism or lack of an ism. I might have an educational philosophy and so on, but I don't need to be, in that sense, accommodated. Well, we might just say, well, fair enough. And the second point, which I think you yourself were making in a way, Craig, is that this doesn't begin with the secularist saying, hey, you're trying to pigeonhole me.
Right.
You're trying to make me into a quasi-religious figure.
Yes.
Lots of religious people make exactly the same point.
Exactly.
And especially, you know, outside the Protestant tradition, and especially outside the Christian tradition.
Right.
So in my talk, a couple of times, I referred to Jews and a couple of other groups, but let's say to Jews, as a religious group who have been racialized.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that may not be a very accurate description. Looking over the long history of the Jews, you might say, well, haven't you really here got an ethnic group with a religion rather than a religious group that's been racialized? Because Jews know they're a people not because of their religious or, you know, theistic beliefs and so on. So there's a sense in which for the Jews, peoplehood comes first. And then it so happens they do have a religion that goes with that people. And so on. And as you're well aware, in the literature, this is exactly the point that people make actually about some Eastern religions like Hinduism,
right,
and the Dharmic religions and so on, that they're really traditions that belong to certain people rather than what,
right,
you know, Christians and even to some extent Muslims have got into calling religions.
A harder point to make about secularists and humanists.
I agree. But that's why I said we needed both those concepts.
Yeah.
We need the concept of religion or belief. So we recognize the importance of the belief component and, as it were, stretch it in a more inclusive way. But we also recognize that what we call religion as a social phenomenon,
mm-hmm,
and also as a lived experience cannot be not only not reduced to belief, but belief might not even be the primary thing for some people.
So let me go to a different question out of this, though actually still fascinated by that one. You talked about new religions, new faiths, by which I think you meant faiths new to Britain.
Yeah, I did.
What about faiths that are new in a different sense, as opposed to old faiths that are new to Britain, Muslims or Buddhists or Sikhs or whatever. What about all of the new religious or religion-like movements that are studied, which some will call cults, but then they're not cults anymore if they last longer and become more mainstream? But what about and sort of seekers and the many people who say in surveys, I'm spiritual but not a member of a religion?
Yeah, well, again, I would ask, are there any public policy provisions? Because I think it'd be fair to say that for quite a lot of British people and people in comparable countries, they may just say, look, I actually don't want the commission about religion and public life, because what the hell has religion got to do with public life? Now, I think, obviously, that they are quite mistaken, and what they're likely to be doing is to be imposing their own understanding of religion on other people who have a different understanding.
Sure.
So I want to accommodate both those who say, I need no public accommodation. In fact, the whole task of separating out the sheep and the goats and pigeonholing and so on is part of the problem. It's not a solution to anything. And those who say, my identity is important to me, and it is being marginalized in the society that pretends that I've got equal rights and claims.
So, accepting that, let me, and in a way I'm pushing the same point, but so let us imagine one person makes a claim for Wiccan beliefs, and another person for Jedi beliefs, or whatever they are, a variety of new religions in this other sense of new religions, or maybe Wiccan is very old and being recreated. Here's the potential policy? Are we creating a situation in which there is actually an incentive to produce claims to public recognition for a variety of engagements that might or might not have made those claims to public religion under other circumstances?
Yeah. I think to an extent that may be the case. I think it is not peculiar to religion. I think once you say that any particular category attracts certain symbolic or material benefits, then whatever it is, I mean, people have said this about race and ethnicity for ages. So I can't deny that some people who may feel they're kind of missing out may then say, oh, we need to organize our own group, and then, you know, go to our boss or go to the vice chancellor or go to the Home Office or whatever and say, hey, you're not making proper provision for us in prisons or in schools or at the BBC or whatever their claim might be. I can see that that can happen with any kind of claims making. I don't see it as a large scale problem. What I think can happen is that all groups, you know, in a shared society, all groups can be influenced by what others are doing. And so I gave you the example of the Awida case, the British Airways staff person who wanted to wear a cross visible to passengers. And BA said, no, wear it tucked into your blouse. That's what everybody else does. And she says, well, that's not what everybody else does. Some people wear their religion on their head. Why can't I wear my religion on my blouse? And it may be that that kind of claim would have had no real traction whatsoever but for the fact that some non-Christians have been pressing parallel claims.
Yeah.
So I think there can be a reactive and cross influences and dynamics. I wouldn't deny that. But I don't really feel that there's a major problem here.
No, I don't think I do either. I think there is a interesting phenomenon that so far hasn't become a major public problem. And I'll ask the last questions, or maybe getting ready with questions from the audience. But you talked about the racialization of Jews, or are Jews an ethnic group, and how does that relate to religion? One might, for many people, there's an issue here about, including many Jews in Britain, about, if you will, the spokespersonization.
Mm.
Who speaks for this group? And groups exist, religions and non-religions exist in public in very significant part through spokespeople who are seldom elected, often self-appointed, may clearly represent some who join organizations that they head, not others who don't. When we speak of these sort of humanist traditions, to what extent is this organizations? To what extent is this philosophical traditions? What are the things? But for Jews or others. So Jews in Britain are very disproportionately represented by Orthodox, non-Hasidic spokespeople. Right? Mm. Christians, really a complicated case, represented largely by Anglicans, but then of course we immediately say they're Catholics, but then they're trying to be Baptists, and they're trying, you know, and each a variety of has some of those labels refer to groups that do not have any organized spokesperson. That is, there's no head of the communion. There are only individual parishes calling priests or ministers or whatever. Others have such a structure. I wonder, not narrowly for Korab, but including Korab, whether we are moving towards a situation in which the production of organizations and spokespeople is privileged as a way of dealing with this.
I don't know about moving to. Has there been a time when an organized group isn't able to press its claim better than an amorphous but possibly larger group. I mean, all the sociology and political science pressure groups suggest that small, effective, organized groups who, you know, have savvy media presence,
sure,
and so on, and of course particular kinds of gatekeeper connections and so on, are likely to get things on their agenda done. So I don't think that this is a new problem. I think that I think in some ways this does connect with the earlier point, that some people might feel, they might feel out of touch with and feel unrepresented by people who speak using a shared community label.
Mm-hmm.
So they hear someone...
Which is a claims making on
them.
Yeah.
So someone goes to 10 Downing Street or speaks to the BBC and says, you know, I represent this Hindu organization and we demand X. And a lot of Hindus who watch that on TV say, do we? I didn't know that. I don't demand it. Well, of course, that's a fairly common phenomenon.
Not to mention,
is
perhaps,
it really increasing?
I don't know
whether it's increasing.
Or
but if it is increasing, I guess this is part of a kind of a general trend towards individualization and disaffiliation, which has been with us for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So I tell you what tends to happen where there is a kind of a genuine kind of public thing to be noted, and that is you have reactive groups forming. And I think that is a good thing. Elsewhere I've written about it, and I kind of have called it the creation of democratic constellations. So people say, oh, the Muslim community is not a monolith. Absolutely right. But they then sometimes talk about it as if it's so heterogeneous that Muslims have nothing in common with each other. So I was trying to find some way of conceptualizing it so as to avoid those two extremes. And I thought, well, think about a constellation. A constellation is a pattern, is a meaningful pattern, you know, the plow or the Big Bear or whatever. It's not just a random set of stars. It stands out from the other stars. But it is a very contingent pattern, and you could look at it and create your own constellations. I personally can't even recognize the existing constellations in the night sky. I just say, oh, well, that looks like something. I don't know what. It looks like a hairdryer or something. So I think what happens is when people feel that the person who is calling up claims in their name from public authorities or in the public sphere generally, they resent that or they disagree or whatever, they then start claiming, you know,
yeah,
Muslims against so-and-so or, you know, whatever it is. So, I think that is a natural democratic process, and in a way I'd rather we had more of that than this kind of more indifferent, apathetic, where people say, well, I don't want to be identified with anything. Because some form of identification is necessary for there to be some kind of coordinated action and for there to be, you know, protest and mobilization against things that are wrong.
Fair enough. And I completely agree. And I want to turn it back to that, but also noting that just that there are differences. There are groups, say Quakers in the Christian traditions, actively determining they're not going to have that kind of organized spokesperson and the hierarchical relations implied.
Mm.
To some extent, Baha'i. There are a variety of groups that are at a disadvantage in a world of organized spokespeople dominated. Public ways of relating to religion. And that may be inevitable, and it may be that there's not a better solution. But there are also democratic reasons why some groups have wanted to have, as it were, locally self-organized units of religion, minimally dependent on hierarchically centralized structures. And it's not Korab that is preventing this, but it's a phenomenon in our society, I think. That's interesting. Questions? Nice. Please.
Thank you.
Can I ask people to say who you are?
My name is Olivia. I don't have any particular affiliation. I'm just interested. My question is, what's the Commission's view on the rise of theft in Sharia courts? And I guess they're often legislating on the basis of quite fundamentalist interpretations. Should our accommodation extend to establishing parallel legal systems?
Yeah, so the Commission did comment on this. And our view was that neither Beth Din nor Sharia councils or Sharia tribunals, as they're sometimes called, are in principle something to be abhorred or criticized. But they may, some of them may be carrying out decision making, you know, adjudication, which is what they exist for, of course, carrying out adjudication that might be in violation of rights that people have in law, in particular women and children, you know, and in particular that would relate to issues around, you know, divorce and custody. And so we said that we would like to see an inquiry. I think we proposed a government-led inquiry. I can't absolutely remember that.
We've now got one.
Sorry?
We've now got one.
We've now got one, yes. So I think we're supportive of that. I don't know exactly its terms of reference, whether that's exactly what we'd want. But we are supportive of an inquiry, which we hope... But the purpose of our inquiry wouldn't be, oh, there's lots of bad things out there which we need to close down. The purpose would be to identify good practice and to find ways of formulating good practice in terms of guidance and then to publicize it. So it's more to do with standard setting and publicizing those standards and so on. And obviously where people's rights are at risk, obviously to prevent that. So I think, I mean, does that answer your question?
It does. I mean, it's slightly worrying, but it does.
Why is it worrying?
I just think we have a standard and it's the law. And if the law needs to change, that's a separate issue. But to, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people, not even conferences on this, it seems to be damaging a lot of the women and children in those communities who don't feel empowered to seek protection under UK law, because the Sharia and Bethlehem councils have been empowered to such a point now. So I think the inquiry would have to be pretty robust.
You say empowered, but of course they can't contradict UK law. So any decisions that they make have to be consistent with UK law. They don't have any power to go against UK law.
What do you mean they can't? Sorry, I didn't understand that. You
well,
say they can't, but it suggests that they do.
Well, if they do, that's one of the things that will come out through an inquiry. And that's why I'm surprised to hear you say you're worried that that's what we proposed, because if there are certain things that should be brought out into, as it were, sunlight, which are being done in, you know, dark, hidden corners, then an inquiry will help to bring that out. And I said that there will be some practices that I'm sure most of us would not want to approve of, certainly members of Korab wouldn't want to approve of, but our judgment is, and I mean, we did visit, not all of us, so it didn't include me personally, but some commissioners visited both a Beth Din and a Sharia council. And of course we studied their material, we studied scholarship on this. One of the members of the commission actually has done herself research on that. That's Professor Mahir Malik at the Law School at King's. So it's not like we were uninformed and just said, oh, there should be some inquiry. We came to that decision on the basis of what is already known. And we said, what is known suggests that we need to know more and we need to have some degree of regulation, which doesn't have to necessarily involve legal regulation. It can involve, as I say, standard setting and then publicising those standards. So you encourage the good, and hopefully that's what then people who want to go to a Beth Din and Sharia will choose. And you're probably aware that the majority of people who choose to go to a Beth Din and Sharia are women, and often they say, I know I have a divorce in UK law, but to me it's not a meaningful divorce. I want a divorce, you know, in the sight of God, or, you know, I want a religiously sanctioned divorce. Mm-hmm. So I think, of course, religious communities should be able to provide that. It is a... Why should we leave women distressed, even if UK law has operated, but they want something extra? But the religious communities themselves have to provide the institutional framework. No one else can do it, but we can have some oversight, and we can help to identify and publicise appropriate standards of how to conduct these things.
A trivial point on this, maybe not, is by far the majority of such extra-legal dispute resolution arbitration have nothing to do with religion. They are arbitration clauses in all manner of contracts, say employment contracts with sports figures who take on the requirement to go to arbitration like this. So there's a huge body of reliance on other kinds of things. It's interesting that it becomes so sensitive.
Yeah.
When it's
interesting. I mean, obviously, just to be clear, perhaps everybody knows this, but just to be clear, Craig doesn't mean that the majority of the business carried out in a Sharia council in Beth Din is
of
that kind, but rather under the law that allows
for
adjudication.
The law allows
for
many kinds of extra legal.
And actually, Sharia councils have developed under that law.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a special law that said, let there be Sharia councils.
Precisely.
There was a law passed under a new Labour period allowing for adjudication because our courts were getting clogged up. And going to court is a very expensive business. So lots of people were clamouring for a simpler adjudication procedure. And so the government created that opportunity. The Sharia councils are one beneficiary, but as Craig says, most adjudication is nothing to do with religion. It's usually to do with business contracts.
Right.
You know, you owe me this and you didn't. Come and let that person sort it out, or, you know, something like that. It just so happens that I read one Sharia council saying that they've had some non-Muslims come to them to ask them to resolve matters of contract to do with building or something.
Landlord-tenant things often. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. If I may, just a few comments, which I would like you to react to.
Who are you?
Very quickly. Keith Borges, Wood National Secular Society. To me, the early discussion about secular beliefs, to me, seemed to be a category area. I mean, secularism in modern parlance, I think, is about equality for everyone, regardless of what they believe. And so whether beliefs are secular or they're not secular is something of indifference to us. And it's almost in the eyes of the beholder, so I don't think it matters very much. And as far as the Equality Act is concerned, effectively it's trying to say, we're not going to discriminate on you whatever you believe or you don't believe. So, given a lot of emphasis earlier. But I just wanted to say, from a sort of an overall perspective, it's come up a few times about public policy and the implications. I mean, I loved your phrase, moderate secularism with an established church. I mean, moderate secularism isn't an established church, I don't think. I mean, even Heiner Bienfeld, the former religion and belief commissioner from the UN, basically says you can't have that without having discrimination against, having quite a lot of discrimination. And he's quite a religious guy. But the sort of areas where I think the non-religious feel kind of short-changed, to say the least, is in an education system to which they don't have equal access, where we have a coronation, where it's just a religious sense. There's no other country, democracy in the world that has either that or the bishops in its parliament, and that does actually cause this disconnect. And Craig was saying, both were, about what these, whether these people have got an organised spokespeople. Well, I mean, by the very definition of what's now the majority of people, they're just heterogeneous and have no spokesperson. And so they're systemically now becoming disadvantaged. And I think that's a huge question, which I don't think CoRab really quite got to terms with. I mean, even in hospitals and with chaplains, yeah, people have needs, whether they have specifically religious affiliations or not. And so it's yet another example. But I would like CoRab to have been an awful lot stronger on say we shouldn't have any discrimination in schools on admissions or on teachers, those kind of things, which it didn't. It sort of identified problems, but in terms of hard solutions, it didn't even mention the coronation. And as far as the bishops were concerned, it's no, let's have a multi-religious representation in Parliament, not the fair way is to level down. That's my last comment.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we clearly disagree, and in fact, I wrote down while you were speaking earlier, equalised downwards ? And that's exactly what you ended up with. So you have a view of equality which consists of dispossessing what some people already enjoy, you know, institutions, organised institutions, churches, faith schools, and so on. And the basis of that, you say, is because you believe that all beliefs should be treated the same. But you go on to say that some people, you know, and this is related to the discussion that we've already had, that quite a lot of people don't feel affiliated to a particular organization or group or whatever. And they don't even want to discuss their beliefs. In fact, they don't even want to discuss their beliefs to themselves. They probably say something like, I don't know what I believe, but I believe something, and it's not worth discussing. Well, that's fine. But what about other people who take a completely different view and who say, I do have some beliefs that are to do with ethical conduct, that are to do with pious conduct, and
time off work.
It could involve time off work.
Worship,
yeah. And that I want to pass this on to the next generation, and I want to be able to have this done in a school system which is obviously compulsory.
And paid for by the state.
Paid for out of my taxes. I'm compelled by law to send my children to school with the threat of prison if I don't, or at least a fine. So surely I can make some claim upon what can be taught at school. And some people say, oh, the most important thing that should be taught at school is music or art or mathematics or science or whatever. But I too have a view, and my view is that my religious heritage is something that I want the school to support me in. And if, as it were, the common school isn't equipped to do it, then why can't I have a school run by my religious organization with, you know, properly trained teachers, a nationally inspected curriculum, and so on? So it's not a kind of Mickey Mouse outfit. We're talking about a properly founded educational institution. And, of course, a lot of faith schools are very well regarded and very popular with all kinds of parents for their children. So how are we to have equality between these two beliefs? One person says, my belief is that talking about religion at school is inappropriate. And I don't want anyone talking about religion in any of the classes at school. So this person is expressing a belief not just about what they need to be permitted to do, but what others may do in order to conform to their beliefs. And then there's another person who says, look, I don't know what others want to do, but can I have a school which caters to my religious heritage duties, because of course religious people have duties to pass on their beliefs to their children. This is what religious people believe. That caters to those duties that I have as a believer, but also provides a rigorous educational curriculum, if you like, a secular curriculum. So, on your view, person A's beliefs trump person B's beliefs. But person B actually isn't talking about what they want in relation to other people, but only in relation to people like themselves. Whereas person A has a very minimal belief system, but it's highly demanding of other people in terms of conformity, and highly ungenerous in terms of what it's willing to tolerate in the public space.
The second answer, as you put it directly to me, I would say that it would be good to have all schools talking about religion to a degree, to some degree of religious literacy, but that that we have schools where everybody comes to, the whole community, whatever their ethno-religious background, nothing is said there which is exclusive for one faith, and it's just that's done more at home and at the place of worship.
Well, we do agree.
Last word.
All right, we do then agree on quite a lot, because I agree with a lot of what you just said, and so does Korab. So Korab recommends that religious education should be a statutory subject, but it should be not religious instruction. All people of all backgrounds should be in the class, and all matters to do with religion, or not one particular religion, but religions in general, including, you know, history and current affairs and ethics, not just about revelations and so on, that a subject like that, which we could call religious education, should be a statutory subject. We also say, as an option, that schools where people want this, so it's not imposing this on anybody, but where there is a demand, that schools should try to cater for specific religious traditions, if necessary, outside school hours. You know, like we have football after school or chess club after school and whatever, we might have a Muslim group that says we want to meet in the school premises after school to pray together, or, you know, to
learn the
Quran, you know, which happens obviously outside school mainly, and sometimes very badly, and it might even happen better if it was happening in an educational institution.
So I now feel a need to remind us that the root meaning of secular has to do with time, and we've run out. Seculum is closest to the modern word century, and we are not to go on for a century here. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Turek. This has been an extremely interesting, and it could indeed go on were we not running out of secular time. So, great. Thank you.
Thank you.